This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Reliquary by Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child. We listen to the unspoken. We gaze upon the unseen. Kakuzo Okakura, The Book of Tea. Old Bones, Part 1. Reliquary, noun. A receptacle such as a shrine or coffer for keeping or displaying sacred relics, usually a piece of the body, a bone, or a personal item from a revered person, thing, saint, or deity. 1. Snow tested his regulator, checked both air valves, ran his hands along the slick neoprene of his suit. Everything was in order just as it had been when he last checked it, 60 seconds before.
"Another 5 minutes,"
the dive sergeant said, cutting the launch to half speed.
"Great,"
came the sarcastic voice of Fernandez over the sound of the big diesel.
"Just great."
Nobody else spoke. Already Snow had noticed that small talk seemed to die away when the team neared a sight. He looked back over the stern, watching the froth of the Harlem River spread out behind the propeller in a brown wedge. The river was wide here, rolling sluggishly under the hot gray haze of the August morning. He turned his gaze toward the shore, grimacing slightly as the rubber cowl pulled at the skin of his neck. Towering apartment buildings with broken windows, ghostly shells of warehouses and factories, an abandoned playground. No, not quite abandoned, one child swinging from a rusty frame.
"Hey, dive master," Fernandez's voice called to him. "Be sure you got your training diapers on."
Snow tugged at the ends of his gloves and continued looking toward the shore.
"Last time we let a virgin out on a dive like this," Fernandez continued, "he shit his suit. Christ, what a mess. We made him sit on the transom all the way back to base. And that was off Liberty Island, too. A friggin' cakewalk compared to the cloaca."
"Fernandez, shut up," the sergeant said mildly. Snow continued to gaze over the stern. When he'd come to scuba from regular NYPD, he had made one big mistake, mentioning that he once worked the Sea of Cortez dive boat. Too late, he'd learned that several of the scuba team had at one time been commercial divers laying cable, maintaining pipelines, working oil platforms. To them, dive masters like him were pampered, underskilled wimps who liked clear water and clean sand. Fernandez, in particular, wouldn't let him forget. The boat leaned heavily to starboard as the sergeant angled in closer to shore. He cut the power even further as they approached a thick cluster of riverfront projects. Suddenly, a small, brick-lined tunnel came into view, breaking the monotony of the gray concrete facades. The sergeant nosed the boat through the tunnel and out into the half-light beyond. Snow became aware of an indescribable smell wafting up from the disturbed waters. Tears sprang involuntarily to his eyes, and he stifled a cough. In the bow, Fernandez looked back, sniggering. Beneath Fernandez's open suit, Snow could see a T-shirt with the police scuba team's unofficial motto, "We dive and shit and look for dead things." Only this time it wasn't a dead thing, but a massive, wrapped brick of heroin thrown off the Humboldt Rail Bridge during a shootout with police the previous night. The narrow canal was lined on both sides by concrete embankments. Ahead, a police launch was waiting beneath the railroad bridge, engine off, bobbing slightly in the striped shadows. Snow could see two people on board, the pilot and a heavy-set man in a badly fitted polyester suit. He was balding, and a wet cigar projected from his lips. He hiked up his pants, spat into the creek, and raised one hand toward them in greeting. The sergeant nodded toward the launch.
"Look who's here." "Lieutenant Agosta," one of the divers in the bow replied. "Must be bad."
"Anytime a cop is shot, it's bad," said the sergeant. The sergeant killed the engine, swinging the stern around so the two launches drifted together. Agosta stepped back to speak with the dive team. As he moved, the police launch heeled over slightly under his shifting weight, and Snow could see that the water left an oily, greenish residue on the hull as it slid away.
"Morning,"
the Agosta said. Normally ruddy-faced, in the darkness beneath the bridge, the lieutenant blinked back at them like a pale cave creature that shunned the light.
"Talk to me, sir," the dive sergeant replied, strapping a depth gauge to his wrist. "What's the deal?"
"The bust went bad,"
the ghostess said. Turns out it was just a messenger boy. He tossed the stuff off that bridge. He nodded upward toward the overhanging structure. Then he shot up a cop and got his own ass aired out good. If we can find the brick, we can close this piece of shit case.
The dive sergeant sighed. If the guy was killed, why call us out? The ghosta shook his head.
What? You gonna leave a 600 grand brick of heroin down there?
Snow looked up. Between the blackened girders of the bridge, he could see the burnt facades of buildings. 1,000 dirty windows stared down at the dead river. Too bad, he thought. The messenger had to throw it into the Humboldt Kill, a.k.a. Cloaca Maxima, named after the great central sewer of ancient Rome. The cloaca was so called because of its centuries-old accumulation of shit, toxic sludge, dead animals, and PCBs. A subway lumbered by above, shuddering and screeching. Beneath his feet, the boat quivered, and the surface of the glistening thick water seemed to jiggle slightly, like gelatin that had begun to set.
"Okay, men," he heard the sergeant say. "Let's get wet."
Snow busied himself with his suit. He knew he was a first-rate diver. Growing up in Portsmouth, practically living in the Piscataqua River, he'd saved a couple of lives over the years. Later, in the Sea of Cortez, he'd hunted shark, done technical diving below 200 feet. Even so, he wasn't looking forward to this particular dip. Though Snow had never been near it before, the team talked about the cloaca often enough back at the base. Of all the foul places to dive in New York City, the cloaca was the worst. Worse than the Arthur Kill, Hellgate, even the Gowanus Canal. Once, he'd heard, it had been a sizable tributary of the Hudson, cutting through Manhattan just south of Harlem's Sugar Hill. But centuries of sewage, commercial construction, and neglect had turned it into a stagnant, unmoving ribbon of filth, a liquid trash can for everything imaginable. Snow waited his turn to retrieve his oxygen tanks from the stainless steel rack, then stepped toward the stern, shrugging them over his shoulders. He still was not used to the heavy, constricting feel of the dry suit. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see the sergeant approaching.
"All set?" came the quiet baritone.
"I think so, sir," Snow said.
What about the headlamps?"
The sergeant stared at him blankly.
"Well, these buildings cut out all the sunlight. We'll need lamps if we're going to see anything, right?"
The sergeant grinned. "It wouldn't make any difference. The cloaca is about 12 feet deep. Below that, there's 10, maybe 15 feet of suspended silt. As soon as your flippers touch that silt, it balloons out like a dust bomb. You won't be able to see beyond your visor. Below the silt is 30 feet of mud. The brick will be buried somewhere in that mud. Down there, you see with your hands."
He looked at Snow appraisingly, hesitating a moment.
"Listen," he said in a low voice. "This won't be like those practice dives in the Hudson. I only brought you along because Cooney and Schultz are still in the hospital."
Snow nodded. The two divers each had gotten a case of the blastos, blastomycosis, a fungal infection that attacked the solid organs, while searching for a bullet-ridden body in a limo at the bottom of the North River the week before. Even with mandatory weekly blood work to screen for parasites, bizarre diseases ruin the health of divers every year.
"If you'd rather sit this one out, it's okay," the sergeant continued. "You can stay here on deck. Help me with the guide ropes."
Snow looked over at the other divers as they strapped on their weight belts, snugged the zippers of their dry suits tight, let the lines over the sides. He remembered the first rule of the scuba team. Every man dives. Fernandez, making a line fast to a cleat, looked back toward them and smirked knowingly.
"I'm diving, sir," Snow said.
The sergeant stared at him for another long moment.
"Remember basic training. Pace yourself. First time down in that muck, divers have a tendency to hold their breath. Don't do it. That's the fastest way to an embolism. Don't overinflate your suit. And for Christ's sake, don't let go of the rope. In the mud, you forget which way is up. Lose the rope and the next body we come looking for will be yours." He pointed to the sternmost guide rope.
"That'll be you."
Snow waited, slowing his breathing while the suit cowl was slipped over his head and the lines attached. Then, after a final check, he went over the side. Even through the stifling, constrictive dry suit, the water felt strange. Viscous and syrupy, it didn't rush past his ears or eddy between his fingers.
Pushing against it was an effort, like swimming in crankcase oil. Tightening his grip on the guide rope, he allowed himself to sink a few feet below the surface. Already the keel of the launch was invisible overhead, swallowed by a miasma of tiny particles that filled the fluid around him. He looked around through the feeble greenish light. Immediately in front of his face, he could see his gloved hand gripping the rope. At a greater distance, he could make out his other hand, outstretched, probing the water. An infinity of motes hung in the space between. He could not see below his feet. There was only blackness. 20 feet down into that blackness, he knew, lay the ceiling of a different world, a world of thick, encasing mud. For the first time in his life, Snow realized just how much he had depended on sunlight and clean water for his sense of security. Even at 50 meters down, the waters in the Sea of Cortez had been clear. Light from his torch had given a sense of openness and space. He let himself drop another several feet, eyes straining into the blackness below. Suddenly, at the outermost reaches of his vision, he saw, or thought he saw through the dim currents, a solid haze beneath him, an undulating, veined surface. It was the layer of silt. He sank toward it slowly, feeling a knot of apprehension grow in his stomach. The sergeant had said that divers often imagined they saw odd things in the thick waters. It was sometimes hard to tell what was real and what was not. His foot touched the strange floating surface, passed through it, and instantaneously a cloud roiled out, folding around him, shutting out all sight. Snow panicked for an instant, scrabbling at the guide rope. Steadying himself with the thought of sniggering Fernandez, he descended. Each movement sent a new storm of black liquid eddying against his visor. He found himself instinctively holding his breath against it, and he forced himself to breathe long, regular breaths.
"This is bullshit," he thought. "My first real dive on the force, and I'm practically a basket case."
He stopped for a moment, controlling his breathing, forcing it back into a steady rhythm. He let himself down the rope a few feet at a time, moving sparingly, trying to relax. With some surprise, he realized that it no longer mattered whether his eyes were open or shut. His mind kept returning to the thick mantle of mud that waited beneath him. Things were in that mud, encased like insects in amber. Suddenly, his boots seemed to touch bottom, but it was unlike any seabed Snow had felt before. This bottom seemed to be decomposing. It yielded beneath his weight with a disgusting kind of rubbery resistance, sneaking up his ankles, then his knees, then his chest, like sinking into clammy quicksand. In a moment, it was over his head, and he was beneath it, and still descending, slower now, encased wholly in an ooze that could not be seen but only felt, pushing close against the neoprene of his dry suit. He could hear the bubbles of his own exhalations working their way upwards around him, not with the quick abandon he was used to, but instead with a slow, flatulent rolling. The mud seemed to offer more resistance as he descended. How far down was he supposed to go in this shit? He swung his free hand about as he had been taught, sweeping it through the muck. It bumped into things. In the blackness with his thick gloves, it was hard to tell what they were. Limbs of trees, crankshafts, nasty snarls of wire, the collected waste of centuries trapped in this graveyard of mud. Another 10 feet, and he'd go back up. Even that bastard Fernandez couldn't snigger after this. Abruptly, his swinging arm bumped against something. When Snow pulled at it, the thing drifted toward him slowly, with the kind of slow resistance that implied weight. Snow tucked the guide rope around the crook of his right arm and felt the thing. Whatever it was not a brick of heroin. He let it go, pushing himself away. The thing swung around in the treacly eddy of his flippers and bumped up against him in the blackness, knocking his visor back and momentarily loosening his regulator. Regaining his balance, Snow began moving his hand over the object, looking for a hold with which to push it away. It was like reaching into a tangle of something, a large tree branch maybe, but it was inexplicably soft in places. He felt along it, feeling the smooth surfaces, the rounded knobs, the pliable lumps. Then, in a flash of understanding, Snow realized he was feeling along a bone. Not just one bone, but several, connected by leathery strips of sinew. It was the half-skeletonized remains of something. A horse, maybe. But as he felt further along its length, he realized that it could only be human. A human skeleton. He tried again to slow his breathing, get his mind working properly. Common sense and training told him he couldn't just leave it there, he'd have to bring it up. He began threading the guide rope through the hip joint and down around the long bones as best he could in the thick muck. He figured there was still enough gristle on the bones to hold the thing together on its trip to the surface. Snow had never tried to tie a knot with gloved fingers in pitch-black mud before. This was something the sergeant hadn't gone into during basic. He hadn't found the heroine, but it was still a stroke of luck. Snow had stumbled onto something important. An unsolved murder, perhaps. Muscle-bound Fernandez would shit a brick when he found out. Yet somehow, Snow felt no exhilaration. All he wanted was to get the hell up and out of this mud. His breath was coming in quick, short pants, and he no longer made any effort to control it. His suit was cold, but he couldn't stop to inflate it now. The rope slipped, and he tried again, holding the skeleton close to him in the ooze to make sure it didn't slip away. Again and again he thought of the yards of mud above his head, the whirlpool of silt above that, the viscous water through which sunlight never penetrated. The rope pulled tight at last, and he gave a mental whimper of thanks. He'd just make sure it was secure, then give three tugs on the line, signaling he'd found something. And then he'd climb up the line and out of this black horror, onto the boat and onto dry land, and maybe then he'd shower for 90 minutes, get drunk, and think about getting his old job back. Dive boat season was just a month away. He checked the rope, feeling it tight around the corpse's long bones. His hands moved up, probing for the ribs, the sternum, threading more rope through the bones, ensuring the fit was snug and that the rope would not slip off when they hauled it topside. His fingers continued to travel upward, only to find that the spinal column tapered off into nothing but black muck. No head! Instinctively, Snow jerked his hand away, then realized in a surge of panic that he had let go of the guide rope. He windmilled his arms and bumped against something, the skeleton again. He grabbed at it desperately, almost hugging it with relief. He quickly felt downward for the rope, grasping and feeling along the long bones, trying to remember just where he'd tied it. The rope wasn't there. Had it come loose? No, that was impossible. He tried to shove it, to turn it, looking for the rope, and suddenly felt his air hose catch on something. He jerked back, disoriented again, and felt the seal on his mask loosening. Something warm and thick began trickling underneath. He tried to shake loose and felt his mask pulled aside, a surge of mud flooding his eyes, oozing into his nose, sucking across his left ear. With escalating horror, he realized that he was tangled in a macabre embrace with a second skeleton. And then came blind, mindless, screaming panic. On the deck of the police launch, Lieutenant DeGosta watched with detached interest as the novice diver was hauled to the surface. He was a remarkable sight, thrashing around, bubbling yells partly muffled by mud, streams of the ochre-colored stuff bleeding away from his dry suit and staining the water chocolate. The diver must have lost his hold on the rope at some point. He was lucky, very lucky, to find his way back to the surface. DeGosta waited patiently while the hysterical diver was brought on board, unsuited, rinsed off, and calmed down. He watched the man vomit over the side. Not on deck, DeGosta noted approvingly. He'd found a skeleton. Two of them, apparently. Not what he'd been sent down for, of course, but not bad for a virgin dive. He would write the poor guy a commendation. The kid would probably be okay if he hadn't breathed in any of that shit that clung to his nose and mouth. If he had, well, it was miraculous what they could do with antibiotics these days. The first skeleton, when it appeared at the churning surface, was still coated with sludge. A side-stroking diver dragged it to the side of DeGosta's launch, eased a net around it, and clambered onto the deck. It was hoisted up the side, scraping and dribbling, sliding onto a tarp at DeGosta's feet like some grisly catch.
"Jesus! You could have rinsed it off a bit," DeGosta said, wincing at the smell of ammonia.
Above the surface, the skeleton became his jurisdiction, and he fervently wished it could simply go back from whence it came. He could see that where the skull should have been, there was nothing.
"Shall I hose it down, sir?"
the diver asked, reaching for the pump.
"Hose yourself down first."
The diver looked ridiculous, an unraveled condom plastered to the side of his head, filth dribbling from his legs. Two divers climbed aboard and began gingerly hauling in another rope, while a third diver brought up the other skeleton, buoying it with a free hand. When it landed on the deck and those aboard saw that it, too, had no head, an awful silence fell. DaGosta glanced over at the huge brick of heroin, also recovered and safely sealed in a rubber evidence bag. Suddenly, the brick had grown a lot less interesting. He drew thoughtfully on a cigar and looked away, scanning the cloaca. His eyes came to rest on the ancient mouth of the west side lateral drain. A few stalactites dripped from the ceiling like small teeth. The west side lateral was one of the biggest in the city, draining practically the entire upper west side. Every time Manhattan got a hard rain, the lower Hudson sewage treatment plant hit capacity and shunted thousands of gallons of raw sewage out the west side lateral right into the cloaca. He tossed the remains of his cigar over the side.
"You guys are going to have to get wet again,"
he said, exhaling loudly.
"I want those skulls."
2. Louis Podelsky, assistant medical examiner for the city of New York, glanced at the clock, feeling his gut rumble. He was, quite literally, starving. He'd had nothing but slim curved shakes for 3 days, and today was his day for a real lunch. Popeye's fried chicken. He ran his hand over his ample gut, probing and pinching, thinking that there might be less there. Yep, definitely less there. He took a gulp from his fifth cup of black coffee and glanced at the ref sheet. Ah, at last, something interesting, not just another shooting, stabbing, or OD. The stainless steel doors at the end of the autopsy suite banged open, and the ME nurse, Sheila Rocco, rolled in a brown corpse and laid it out on a gurney. Podelsky glanced at it, looked away, glanced back again. Corpse was the wrong word, he decided. The thing on the gurney was little more than a skeleton, covered with shreds of flesh. Podelsky wrinkled his nose. Rocco positioned the gurney under the lights and began hooking up the drainage tube.
"Don't bother," Podelsky said.
The only thing that needed draining around here was his coffee cup. He took a large swallow, tossed it into the wastebasket, checked the corpse's tag against the ref sheet and initialed it, then pulled on a pair of green latex gloves.
"What have you brought for me now, Sheila?"
he asked.
"Piltdown man?"
Rocco frowned and adjusted the lights above the gurney.
"This one must have been buried for a couple centuries at least. Buried in shit, too, from the smell of it. Whew! Yeah, perhaps it's King Shit-in-Common himself."
Rocco pursed her lips and waited while Podelsky roared with laughter. When he was finished, she silently handed him a clipboard. Podelsky scanned the sheet, lips moving as he read the typed sentences. Suddenly he straightened up.
"Catched out of humble kill," he muttered. "Christ almighty."
He eyed the nearby glove dispenser, considered putting on an extra pair of gloves, decided against it.
Decapitated? Head still missing, no clothing, but found with a metal belt around its waist.
He glanced over at the cadaver and spied the ID bag hanging from the gurney.
"Let's have a look," he said, taking up the bag.
Inside was a thin gold belt with an Uffizi buckle, set with a topaz. It had already been run through the lab, he knew, but he still wasn't allowed to touch it. He noticed the belt had a number on its back plate.
"Expensive," Podelsky said, nodding toward the belt. "Maybe it's Piltdown Woman. Or a transvestite."
And he roared again. Rocco frowned.
"May we show the dead a little more respect, Dr. Podelsky?"
"Oh, of course, of course."
He hung the clipboard on a hook and adjusted the microphone that hung above a gurney.
"Switch on the tape recorder, will you, Sheila, darling?"
As the machine snapped on, his voice suddenly became clipped and professional.
"This is Dr. Louis Podelsky. It's August 2nd, 12:05 p.m. I am assisted by Sheila Rocco, and we're commencing examination of..."
He glanced at the tag.
"Number A1430. We have here a headless corpse, virtually skeletonized. Sheila, will you straighten it out? Perhaps 4 feet 8 inches in length. Add the missing skull, and you've probably got someone 5 foot 6, 7. Let's sex the skeleton. Pelvic rim's a little wide. Yep, it's gynecoid. We've got a woman here. No lipping of the lumbar vertebrae, so she's under 40. Hard to say how long she's been submerged. There is a distinct smell of sewage. The bones are a brownish-orange color and look like they've been in mud for a long time. On the other hand, there is sufficient connective tissue to hold the corpse together, and there are ragged ends of muscle tissue around the medial and lateral condyles of the femur, and more clinging to the sacrum and ischium. Plenty of material for blood typing and DNA analysis. Scissors, please.
He snipped off a piece of tissue and slipped it into a bag.
Sheila, could you turn the pelvis over on its side? Now, let's see. The skeleton is still mostly articulated, except, of course, for the missing skull. Looks like the axis is also missing. 6 cervical vertebrae remaining, missing the 2 floating ribs and the entire left foot.
He continued, describing the skeleton. Finally, he moved away from the microphone.
Sheila, the rongeur, please.
Rocco handed him a small instrument, which Podelsky used to separate the humerus from the ulna.
Periosteum elevator?
He dug into the vertebrae, removing a few samples of connective tissue, cutting away at the bone. Then he pulled a pair of disposable plastic goggles over his head.
Saw, please?
She handed him a small, nitrogen-driven saw, and he switched it on, waiting a moment while the tachometer reached the correct RPM. When the diamond blade touched the bone, a high-pitched whine, like an enraged mosquito, filled the small room. Along with it came the sudden smell of bone dust, sewage, rotten marrow, and death. Podelsky took sections at various points, which Rocco sealed in bags.
I want SEM and stereo-zoom pictures of each microsection, Podelsky said, stepping away from the gurney and turning off the recorder.
Rocco wrote the requests on the Ziploc bags with a large black marker. A knock sounded at the door. Sheila went to answer, stepped outside for a moment, then poked her head back in.
They have a tentative ID from the belt, doctor, she said. It's Pamela Wisher.
Pamela Wisher? The society girl? Asked Podelsky, taking off the goggles and backing off a little. Jeez!
And there's a second skeleton, she continued, from the same place.
Podelsky had moved to a deep metal sink, preparing to remove his gloves and wash up.
Second one? He asked irritably. Why the hell didn't they bring it in with the first? I should have been looking at them side by side.
He glanced at the clock. 1:15 already. God damn it! That meant no lunch until at least 3. He felt faint with hunger. The doors banged open, and the second skeleton was wheeled under the bright light. Podelsky turned the tape recorder back on and went to pour himself yet another cup of coffee while the nurse did the prep work.
This one's headless, too, Rocco said.
You're kidding, right?
Podelsky replied. He walked forward, glanced at the skeleton, then froze, coffee cup to his lips.
What the?
He lowered the cup and stared, open-mouthed. Laying the cup aside, he stepped up quickly to the gurney and bent over the skeleton, running the tips of his gloved fingers lightly over one of the ribs.
Dr. Podelsky? Rocco asked.
He straightened, went back to the tape recorder, and brusquely switched it off.
Cover it up and get Dr. Brambell. And don't breathe a word about this, he nodded at the skeleton, to anyone.
She hesitated, looking at the skeleton with a puzzled expression, her eyes gradually widening.
I mean now, Sheila, darling.
3. The phone rang abruptly, shattering the stillness of the small museum office. Margot Green, face mere inches from her computer terminal, sat back guiltily in her chair, a shock of short brown hair falling across her eyes. The phone rang again, and she moved to answer it, then hesitated. No doubt it was one of the computer jocks in data processing calling to complain about the enormous amount of CPU time her cladistic regression program was soaking up. She settled back and waited for the phone to stop ringing, the muscles of her back and legs pleasantly sore from the previous night's workout. Picking up the hand trainer from her desk, she began squeezing it in a routine so familiar it had grown almost instinctive. Another 5 minutes, and her program would be finished. Then they could complain all they wanted. She knew about the new cost-cutting policy requiring that large-batch jobs be submitted for approval, but that would have meant a flurry of email before she could run the program, and she needed the results right away. At least Columbia, where she'd been an instructor until accepting the assistant curatorship at the New York Museum of Natural History, wasn't always in the midst of some new round of budget cutting. And the more the museum got into financial trouble these days, the more it seemed to rely on show instead of substance. Already, Margot had noticed the early build-up for next year's blockbuster exhibition, 21st Century Plagues. She glanced up at the screen to check the progress of her regression program, then put down the hand trainer, reached into her bag, and drew out the New York Post. The Post and a cup of black Kilimanjaro coffee had become her weekday morning ritual. There was something refreshing about the Post's truculent attitude, like that of the fat boy in the Pickwick Papers. Besides, she knew she'd catch hell from her old friend Bill Smith back if he ever found out she'd missed a single homicide article carrying his byline. She smoothed the tabloid on her knees, grinning at the headline despite herself. It was vintage Postian, a screaming 96-point banner that covered three-quarters of the front page.
Sewage corpse identified as missing Deb.
She glanced down at the opening paragraph. Sure enough, it was Smithback's work. Second front-page article this month, she thought. On the strength of this, Smithback would be strutting and primping, even more impossible to be around than usual. She quickly skimmed the article. It was quintessential Smithback, sensationalist and macabre, full of loving attention to the gruesome details. In the opening paragraphs, he quickly summarized the facts that were by now well known to all New Yorkers. The beautiful trust funder, Pamela Wisher, known for her marathon late-night carousings, had disappeared 2 months earlier from a basement club on Central Park South. Ever since, her smiling face with its dazzling teeth, vacant blue eyes, and expensive blonde hair had been plastered at every street corner from 57th to 96th. Margot had often seen the color photocopies of Wisher as she jogged to the museum from her apartment on West End Avenue. Now, the article breathlessly announced the remains found the previous day, buried in raw sewage, in humbled kill, and locked in a bony embrace with another skeleton, had been identified as Pamela Wisher's. The second skeleton remained unidentified. An accompanying photo showed Wisher's boyfriend, the young Viscount Adair, sitting on the curb in front of the Platypus Lounge with his head in his hands minutes after learning of her grisly death. The police were, of course, taking vigorous action. Smithback closed with several man-on-the-street quotations of the "I hope they fry the bastard who did this" variety. She lowered the paper, thinking of the grainy face of Pamela Wisher staring out at her from the numerous posters. She deserved a better fate than becoming New York's big story of the summer. The shrill sound of the phone again interrupted Margot's thoughts. She glanced over at her terminal, pleased to see that the program had finished at last.
Might as well answer it, she thought.
She'd have to get this lecture over with sooner or later. This is Margot Green, she said.
Dr. Green?
Came the voice.
About time.
The thick Queen's accent was distantly familiar, like a half-forgotten dream. Gruff, authoritarian. Margot searched her memory for the face belonging to the voice on the other end of the phone.
All we can say is that a body has been found on the premises under circumstances we are currently investigating.
She sat back in surprise.
Lieutenant DeGosta? She asked.
We need you in the forensic anthropology lab,
DeGosta said.
Right away, please.
Can I ask?
You may not. Sorry. Whatever you're doing, forget it and come downstairs.
The line went dead with a sharp click. Margot held the phone away from her face, looking at the mouthpiece as if waiting for further explanation. Then she opened her carryall and replaced the Post, carefully covering a small semi-automatic pistol in the process. Pushed the chair away from the computer, and stepped quickly out of her office. 4. Bill Smithback strolled nonchalantly past the grand facade of 9 Central Park South,
a stately McKim, Mead, and White building of brick and carved limestone. A brace of doormen stood beneath the gold-trimmed awning that stretched to the curb. He could see a variety of other service people standing at attention inside the opulent lobby. As he'd feared, it was one of those ridiculously overstaffed park-front apartment buildings. This was going to be tough. Very tough. He turned the corner of 6th Avenue and paused, considering how best to proceed. He felt in the outside pocket of his sports jacket, locating the record button of his microcassette recorder. He could turn it on unobtrusively when the time came. He glanced at his image, reflected among countless Italian shoes in a nearby shop window. He was the very model of preppydom, or as near as his wardrobe would permit. He took a deep breath and returned around the corner, walking with confident step toward the cream-colored awning. The closer of the two uniformed doormen gazed at him imperturbably, one gloved hand on the great brass handle of the door.
"I'm here to see Mrs. Wisher," Smithback said.
"Name, please?" the man asked in a monotone.
"A friend of Pamela's."
"I'm sorry," the man said, unmoving, "but Mrs. Wisher is not receiving any visitors." Smithback thought quickly. The doorman had asked who was calling before telling him this. That meant Mrs. Wisher was expecting someone.
"If you must know, it's about this morning's appointment," Smithback said. "I'm afraid there's been a change. Could you ring her for me?"
The doorman hesitated a moment, then opened the door leading Smithback across the gleaming marble floor. The journalist looked around. The concierge, a very old and very gaunt-looking man, was standing behind a bronze construction that looked more fortress than front desk. At the back of the lobby, a security guard sat behind a Louis XVI table. An elevator operator stood beside him, legs slightly apart, hands folded across his belt.
"This gentleman is calling on Mrs. Wisher," the doorman said to the concierge.
The concierge gazed down at him from his marble pillbox.
"Yes?"
Smithback took a deep breath. At least he'd broached the lobby.
"It's about the appointment she's expecting. There's been a change."
The concierge paused a moment, his hooded eyes checking out Smithback's shoes, running up his sport coat, examining his haircut. Smithback waited, silently chafing under the examination, hoping he'd captured the look of an earnest young man from a well-to-do family.
"Who may I say is calling?"
the concierge rasped.
"A friend of the family will do."
The concierge waited, staring at him.
"Bill Smithback," he added quickly.
Mrs. Wisher, he was certain, did not read the New York Post. The concierge looked down at something that was spread in front of him.
"What about the 11 o'clock appointment?" he asked.
"They sent me instead," Smithback replied, suddenly glad that it was 10:32 a.m. The concierge turned around and disappeared into a small office. He came out again 60 seconds later.
"Please pick up the house telephone on the table beside you," he said.
Smithback held the receiver to his ear.
"What? Did George cancel?"
said a small, crisp, expensive voice.
"Mrs. Wisher, may I come up and speak with you about Pamela?"
There was a silence.
"Who is this?"
the voice asked.
"Bill Smithback."
There was another silence, longer this time. Smithback continued.
"I have something very important, some information about your daughter's death that I am sure the police haven't told you. I feel sure you would want to know..."
The voice broke in.
"Yes, yes, I'm sure you do."
"Wait,"
Smithback said, his mind racing again. There was a silence.
"Mrs. Wisher?"
He heard a click. The woman had hung up. Well, Smithback thought, he had given it his best shot. Maybe he could wait outside on a park bench across the street on the chance she'd emerge later in the day. But even as he considered this, Smithback knew that Mrs. Wisher would not be leaving her elegant fastness for the foreseeable future. A phone rang at the concierge's elbow. Mrs. Wisher, no doubt. Eager to avoid a bum's rush, Smithback turned and started walking quickly out of the lobby.
"Mr. Smithback!"
the concierge called loudly. Smithback turned. This was the part he hated. The concierge gazed at him expressionlessly, telephone at his ear.
"The elevator is over there."
"Elevator?"
Smithback asked. The concierge nodded.
18th floor."
The elevator operator slid open first the brass cage, then the heavy oak doors,
depositing Smith back directly into a peach-colored foyer crammed top to bottom with flower arrangements. A side table was overflowing with sympathy cards, including a fresh stack that had not been opened. At the far end of the silent room, a set of French doors stood ajar. Smithback walked toward them slowly. Beyond the doors lay a large drawing room. Empire sofas and chaise lounges were placed at neat, symmetric angles on the dense carpet. Along the far wall stood a series of tall windows. Smithback knew that, when open, they would afford a spectacular view of Central Park. But now they were tightly closed and shuttered, throwing the tastefully appointed space into heavy gloom. There was a brief movement to one side. Turning, Smithback saw a small, neat woman with well-coiffed brown hair, seated at one end of a sofa. She was wearing a dark, simple dress. Without speaking, she motioned him to sit down. Smithback selected a wing chair opposite Mrs. Wisher. A tea service had been laid out on a low table between them, and the journalist's eye roved over the array of scones, marmalades, dishes of honey, and clotted cream. The woman made no move to offer any, and Smithback realized the setting had been for the intended appointment. A brief uneasiness came across him at the thought that George, no doubt the real 11 o'clock arrival, might appear at any moment. Smithback cleared his throat.
Mrs. Wisher, I'm very, very sorry about your daughter, he said.
As he spoke, he realized he might actually mean it. Seeing this elegant room, seeing how little all this wealth mattered in the face of ultimate tragedy, somehow brought the woman's loss forcefully home to him. Mrs. Wisher continued to gaze back, hands folded in her lap. She may have made a barely perceptible nod, but Smithback couldn't be sure in the dim light.
Time to get the show on the road,
he thought, reaching casually into his jacket pocket and slowly pressing the record button.
Turn off that tape recorder,
said Mrs. Wisher quietly. Her voice was thin and a little strained, but remarkably commanding. Smithback jerked his hand out of the pocket.
I'm sorry. Please remove the recorder from your pocket and place it here where I can see that it's turned off.
Yes, of course, Smithback said, fumbling with the machine.
Have you no sense of decency?
The woman whispered. Smithback, placing the recorder on the low table, felt his ears begin to burn.
You say you're sorry about my daughter's death,
the quiet voice continued,
while at the same time turning on that filthy thing, after I invited you into my home.
Smithback shifted uncomfortably in his chair, reluctant to meet the woman's eyes.
Yes, well, he babbled. I'm sorry, I'm just... Well, it's my job.
The words sounded lame even as he spoke them.
Yes, I've just lost my only child, the only family I had left. Whose sensitivities do you think should take precedence, Mr. Smithback?
Smithback fell silent, forcing himself to look at the woman. She sat unmoving, staring steadily back at him across the gloom, hands still folded on her lap. A strange thing was happening to him, a very strange thing, so foreign to his nature that he almost didn't recognize the emotion. He was feeling embarrassed. No, that wasn't it. He was feeling ashamed. If he'd fought for the scoop, unearthed it himself, perhaps it would be different. But to be brought up here, to see the woman's grief, all the excitement of getting assigned a big story drained away beneath this novel sensation. Mrs. Wisher raised one of her hands and made the briefest of movements, indicating something on a reading table beside her.
I assume you are the Smithback who writes for this paper?
Smithback followed her gesture and noticed, with a sinking feeling, a folded copy of the Post.
Yes,
he said. She folded her hands again.
I just wanted to be sure. Now, what about that important information regarding my daughter's death? No, don't say it. No doubt that was a ruse as well.
There was another silence. Now Smithback found himself almost wishing that the real 11 o'clock appointment would show up. Anything to get out of here.
How do you do it?
She asked at last.
Do what? Invent this garbage. It isn't enough for my daughter to be brutally murdered. People like you have to sully her memory.
Smithback swallowed.
Mrs. Wisher, I'm just...
Reading this filth, she continued. One would think that Pamela was just some selfish society girl who got what she deserved.
You make your readers glad my daughter was murdered. So, what I wonder is simple. How do you do it?
Mrs. Wisher, people in this town don't pay attention to something unless you slap them in the face with it,
Smithback began, then stopped. Mrs. Wisher wasn't buying his self-justification any more than he was. The woman sat forward very slowly on the sofa.
You know absolutely nothing about her, Mr. Smithback. You only see what's on the surface. That's all you're interested in.
Not true, Smithback burst out, surprising himself. I mean, that's not all I'm interested in. I want to know the real Pamela Wisher.
The woman regarded him for a long moment. Then she stood up and left the room, returning with a framed photograph. She handed it to Smithback. A girl of about 6 was pictured, swinging on a rope tied to a massive oak branch. The girl was hollering at the camera, her 2 front teeth missing, pinafore and pigtails flying.
That's the Pamela I'll always remember, Mr. Smithback, Mrs. Wisher said evenly. If you really are interested, then print this picture. Not that one you keep running that makes her look like a brainless debutante.
She sat down again, smoothing her dress around her knees.
She was just beginning to smile again after the death of her father 6 months ago, and she wanted to have some fun before starting work this fall. What's criminal about that?
Work? Smithback asked. There was a short silence. Smithback felt Mrs. Wisher's eyes on him in the funereal gloom.
That's correct. She was starting a job in a hospice for AIDS patients. You would have known that if you'd done your research.
Smithback swallowed.
That's the real Pamela,
the woman said, her voice suddenly breaking.
Kind, generous, full of life. I want you to write about the real Pamela.
I'll do my best, Smithback mumbled. Then the moment was over, and Mrs. Wisher was again composed and distant. She inclined her head, made a brief movement of her hand, and Smithback realized he had been released. He mumbled his thanks, retrieved his tape recorder, and headed for the elevator as quickly as he dared.
One other thing,
Mrs. Wisher said, her voice suddenly grown hard. Smithback stopped at the French doors.
They can't tell me when she died, why she died, or even how she died, but Pamela will not have died in vain. I promise you that.
She spoke with a new intensity, and Smithback turned to face her.
You said something just now, she went on. You said that people in this town don't pay attention to something unless you slap them in the face with it. That's what I intend to do.
How?
Smithback asked. But Mrs. Wisher withdrew onto the sofa, and her face fell into deep shadow. Smithback walked through the foyer and rang for the elevator, feeling drained. It wasn't until he was back on the street, blinking in the strong summer light, that he looked down again at the childhood picture of Pamela Wisher, still clutched in his right hand. It was beginning to dawn on him exactly how formidable a woman Mrs. Wisher was. 5. The metal door at the end of the gray hallway was discreetly marked Forensic Anthropology in stenciled capitals. It was the museum's state-of-the-art facility for analyzing human remains. Margot tried the knob, turned it, and to her surprise found it locked. This was odd. She'd been here countless times, assisting in examinations of everything from Peruvian mummies to Anasazi cliff dwellers, and the door had never been locked before. She lifted her hand to knock, but the door was already being opened from the inside, and she found her wrap falling onto thin air. She stepped in, then stopped abruptly. The lab, normally brightly lit and bustling with grad students and curatorial assistants, looked dim and strange. The bulky electron microscopes, X-ray viewers, and electrophoresis apparatus sat against the walls, silent and unused. The window that normally boasted a panoramic view of Central Park was covered by a heavy curtain. A single pool of brilliant light illuminated the center of the room. At its edge, a semicircle of suited figures stood among the shadows. In the center of the light lay a large specimen table. Something brown and knobby lay on it, along with the blue plastic sheet covering some other long, low object. As she stared curiously, Margot realized that the knobby object was a human skeleton, decorated with desiccated strips of sinew and flesh. There was a faint but unmistakable odor of corpse reek. The door closed and locked behind her,
Lieutenant Vincent D'Agosta, wearing what looked like the same suit she remembered from the Museum Beast murders of 18 months before, walked back to join the group, nodding briefly at her as he passed. He seemed to have shed a few pounds since she'd last seen him. Margot noticed that his suit matched the dirty brown color of the skeleton. Margot scanned the row of figures as her eyes adjusted to the dim light. To D'Agosta's left was a nervous man in a lab coat, a cup of coffee gripped in his pudgy hand. Next came the tall, thin form of the museum's new director, Olivia Merriam. Another figure stood farther back in the shadows, too dim for Margot to make out anything but a vague outline. The director gave Margot a wan smile.
"Thank you for coming, Dr. Green. These gentlemen," she waved vaguely in D'Agosta's direction, "have asked for our help."
There was a silence. Finally, D'Agosta sighed irritably.
"We can't wait for him any longer. He lives way the hell out in Mendham and didn't seem too thrilled about coming in when I telephoned last night."
He looked at each person in turn.
"You saw the Post this morning, right?"
The director looked at him with distaste.
"No."
"Let me backtrack a bit, then."
D'Agosta gestured toward the skeleton on the stainless steel table.
"Meet Pamela Wisher, daughter of Annette and the late Horace Wisher. No doubt you've seen her picture all over town. She disappeared around 3 a.m. on the morning of May 23rd. She spent the evening at the Wine Cellar, one of those basement clubs off Central Park South. Went to make a phone call and never came back. At least, not until yesterday, when we found her skeleton, minus the skull, in the Humboldt Kill. Apparently it was flushed out of a west side storm drain, probably during a recent heavy rain."
Margot looked again at the remains on the table. She had seen countless skeletons before, but none belonging to anyone she'd known, or even heard of. It was difficult to believe that this grisly assemblage of bones had once been the pretty blonde woman she had been reading about barely 15 minutes before.
"And with the remains of Pamela Wisher, we also found this."
D'Agosta nodded at the thing lying beneath the blue plastic sheet.
"So far, the press knows only that a second skeleton was found. Thank God."
He glanced at the figure standing apart in the shadows.
"I'll let Dr. Simon Bramble, chief medical examiner, do the talking."
As the figure stepped into the light, Margot saw a slender man of about 65. The skin lay tight and smooth across a devious old skull, and a pair of beady black eyes glittered at the assembled company behind ancient horn rims. His long, lean face was as devoid of expression as his head was devoid of hair. He laid a finger across his upper lip.
"If you would all take a few steps forward," he said in a soft Dublin accent, "you might have a better view."
There was a sound of reluctant shuffling. Dr. Bramble grasped the end of the blue sheet, paused a moment to look impassively around again, then flipped it off with a deft motion. Beneath, Margot saw the remains of another headless corpse, as brown and decayed as the first. But as her eyes scanned the remains, she sensed there was something odd. Her breath drew in sharply as she realized what it was. The bizarre thickening of the leg bones, the odd curvatures of several of the major joint structures, was all wrong.
"What the hell?"
she thought. There came a sudden thump on the door.
"Christ!"
D'Agosta moved toward it quickly.
"At last!"
The door swung wide to reveal Whitney Cadwallader Frock, the famous evolutionary biologist, now a reluctant guest of Lieutenant D'Agosta. His wheelchair creaked as it approached the specimen table. Without looking at the assembled company, he examined the bony corpses, his eyes coming to rest on the second skeleton. After a few moments, he leaned back, a shock of white hair falling away from his wide pink forehead. He nodded at D'Agosta and the museum director. Then he saw Margot, and a look of surprise came over his face, changing quickly to a delighted smile. Margot smiled and nodded in return. Although Frock had been her primary advisor during her graduate work at the museum, she had not seen him since his retirement party. He had left the museum to concentrate on his writing, yet there was still no sign of the promised follow-up volume to his influential work, Fractal Evolution. The medical examiner, who had paid Frock's entrance only the briefest of glances, now continued.
"I invite you," he said pleasantly, "to examine the ridging of the long bones, the bony spicules and osteophytes along the spine and at the joints. Also the 20-degree outward rotation of the trochanters. Note that the ribs have a trapezoidal instead of the normal prismatic cross-section. Finally,
I would direct your attention to the thickening of the femurs. On the whole, a rather unbecoming fellow. Of course, these are only some of the more outstanding features. You can no doubt see the rest for yourselves.
The ghost breathed out through his nose.
Yeah, no doubt.
Frock cleared his throat.
Naturally, I haven't had a chance for a thorough examination, but I wonder if you've considered the possibility of Dish.
The M.E. looked at Frock again more carefully this time.
A very intelligent guess, he said, but quite wrong. Dr. Frock is referring to diffuse idiopathic skeletal hyperostosis, a type of severe degenerative arthritis.
He shook his head dismissively.
Nor is it osteomalacia, though if this wasn't the 20th century, I'd say it was the worst nightmarish case of scurvy ever recorded. We've searched the medical databases and can find nothing that would account for this condition.
Brumbell ran his fingers lightly, almost affectionately, along the spinal column.
There is another curious anomaly shared by both skeletons, which we only noticed last night. Dr. Podelsky, would you please bring the stereo zoom?
The overweight man in the lab coat disappeared into the gloom, then returned, rolling before him a large stereo-zoom microscope with an open stage. He positioned it over the neck bones of the deformed skeleton, peered through the eyepieces, made a few adjustments, then stepped back. Brumbell gestured with the palm of his hand.
Dr. Frock?
Frock rolled forward and, with some difficulty, fit his face to the visor. He remained motionless for what seemed several minutes, leaning over the skeletonized cadaver. At last he rolled his wheelchair back, saying nothing.
Dr. Green, the M.E. said, turning to her.
Margot stepped up to the microscope and peered in, aware of being the focus of attention. At first she could make nothing of the image. Then she realized that the stereo zoom was focused on what appeared to be a cervical vertebra. There were several shallow, regular scores along one edge. Some foreign, brownish matter clung to the bone, along with bits of cartilage, strings of muscle tissue, and a greasy bulb of adipocere. Slowly she straightened up, feeling the old familiar fear return, unwilling to consider what those scores along the bone reminded her of. The M.E. raised his eyebrows.
Your opinion, Dr. Green?
Margot drew in her breath.
If I were to guess, I'd say they look like teeth marks.
She and Frock exchanged glances. She knew now, they both knew, exactly why Frock had been called to this meeting. Brumbell waited while the others took turns staring through the microscope. Then, wordlessly, he wheeled the stereo zoom over to Pamela Wisher's skeleton, focusing this time on the pelvis. Again, Frock took up a position at the microscope, followed by Margot. No denying it this time. Margot noticed that some of the marks had punctured the bone and penetrated into the marrow spaces. Frock blinked in the cold white light.
Lieutenant DeGosta told me these skeletons came out of the west side lateral drain.
That's right, said DeGosta.
Flushed out by the recent storm?
That's the theory.
Perhaps feral dogs worried our couple while their dead bodies lay in the drain system.
That's one possibility, said Brumbell. I would estimate the pressure required to make the deepest of those pressure marks at around 1,200 PSI. A bit high for a dog, don't you think?
Not for, say, a Rhodesian Ridgeback, said Frock.
Brumbell inclined his head.
Or the Hound of the Baskervilles, Professor?
Frock frowned at the sarcasm.
I'm not convinced those marks are as powerful as you believe.
Alligator, said DeGosta.
All heads turned toward him.
Alligator, he repeated, almost defensively. You know, they get flushed down the toilets as babies, then grow big in the sewers.
He looked around.
So I read somewhere.
Brumbell issued a chuckle as dry as dust.
Alligators, like all reptiles, have cone-shaped teeth. These marks were made by small, triangular mammalian teeth, probably canines.
Canine, but not dog, Frock said. Let's not forget the principle of Occam's razor. The simplest explanation is usually the correct one.
Brumbell tilted his head in Frock's direction.
I know that Occam's razor is held in great esteem in your profession, Dr. Frock. In mine, we find the Holmesian philosophy more apt.
When you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
So what answer remains, Dr. Bramble? Frock snapped.
As of this moment, I have no explanation.
Frock settled back in the wheelchair. This second